Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Arsenal get battered everywhere they go. Arsenal get battered
everywhere they go. Everywhere they go.
Hello, Windy.
And a man who knows better than anyone that Arsenal get battered everywhere they go. Arsenal get battered everywhere they go. It's Nathan Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hello, Windy.
I didn't actually say our tactics guy. That felt wrong then. Our tactics guy. I think I did say it. No, I did say it. It's fine. I said it.
On an occasion like this, kind of decorum and manners all goes out the window. We can all be a sweaty, heaving mess, and we're allowed to do things that we don't normally do, which kind of like what happened to me at Arsenal on Thursday. So we're allowed to be a bit naughty.
A little bit naughty. Yeah,
little bit. Because they don't like it up and windy. That's what happens.
It's true.
We brutalise them.
What did I say last week? Rattled as fuck.
Truly rattled.
Before we get into that, and my goodness, are we going to get into that? Just to say once again that we launched some new merch last week, which you can see on theextrainch.co.uk. There's a tab for shop. And you can also, if you don't wish to subscribe to our Patreon, you can buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com/theextrainch. It's a nice way of showing your support. It's £3. £3 if you want to show support to your boys. We had a massive discussion to our response about hair loss last week. I am going to read some bits and bobs towards the end of the podcast. So if that interests you, stay tuned. Bardi, Cal the Aggregator, legend that he is, says, is this what true happiness feels like?
I mean, it's pretty close. You know, getting into the Champions League at the expense of them and the way they've kind of crumbled, it is, yeah, it's pretty close to true happiness. I don't think Spurs winning the league is something that we can contemplate, or winning the Champions League. So, yeah, this is pretty good. It may not be a trophy for the people that want something to lift, and I've been one of those guys for a while, but this is proper happiness.
I love it. And I completely agree. You've got to take these, moments and run with them while we can. Is there any part of your body that thinks that we need to wait until Sunday before we get overexcited?
Yeah, of course. There's a huge part of me which is concerned. Straight after the final whistle yesterday, Nima slid into my DMs, which he likes to do when Conte has a big result. He doesn't come into my DMs when he's messed up, but he came into my DMs yesterday celebrating along with me. And he said this was one of Conte's three miracles, along with taking a terrible Italy team to the quarterfinals in 2016 and keeping Siena in promotion with Siena to Serie A. So he reckons this is an incredible feat by Conte, and he's very happy for us. But I told him I'm not celebrating yet. I mean, I'm very happy at what we've done, but yeah, it's still not done, Windy. It's still not official.
I think it's done.
It's not done. It isn't done.
Not only hasn't it been done,
but yeah.
I think we're going to batter Norwich. And I also don't think Arsenal will beat Everton.
Have you been watching Tottenham for the last 35 years? It doesn't quite work like that.
I'm not worried. I'm not worried about us having a Spursy moment at Norwich because we're in pole position. And as you pointed out, Arsenal have to go to Everton. And as we know, Arsenal get bad.
everywhere they go.
But Everton are pretty bad, and you know, like, Dele's not going to pull out 12 goals and assists in one game. So
he's not going to play.
Yeah, I'm not too worried. Let's get stuck into the North London derby. Peter Strum says, "How beautiful was the NLD?" It was very beautiful, Peter. It was absolutely perfect in every way. Let's start with the lineup. We knew not long before kickoff that Romero was going to be.
There was ITK going around that Romero was out, which I refuse to believe. I refuse to believe. I was like an anti-vaxxer on this. It's not true. And when it turned out to be true, I was concerned because even though I like Big Dave, I was worried about his ability to pass out the back against a team which I thought would be pretty good at stopping us that way.
Yeah, I'd been excited about the match for a few days in advance, and then in the hour or so before, I was dreading it because of that late team news.
I still felt good about it, to be honest. I completely agree with Bardi about Sanchez. I mean, obviously, it's a huge downgrade in terms of our ability to play out, and there was a concern there for sure. There was a concern there, but I felt like we were such a good stylistic match for Arsenal, and I felt like the rest of our players were in such a good place that it was all going to be fine. It was all going to be absolutely fine. And it was. And Sanchez had a rough opening. You know, his first touch of the ball was a lump forward, right? he didn't cover himself in glory in those early stages. But as Arsenal's press declined and Sanchez had more time in the ball, he was absolutely more than adequate and he did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
I just want to touch back on Peter Strom's question because I went down to Tottenham pretty early on Thursday, probably too early, earlier than my body could take. And it was really nice to be back at the stadium playing a big match against a proper rival and have something at stake other than just the game. Because a lot of times recently we've played these games and the only thing that really mattered was that 90 minutes. There wasn't any kind of long-term repercussions. And there was just an energy around the place. Even getting there early, you could feel it. And then as the game got closer and closer, and we kind of hung out on the high street watching the people kind of swell and hang outside the stadium. It was really, really nice from a Tottenham point of view. And that you could see and you could feel that if you're an Arsenal fan walking up through that, then it would have an effect on you. And it was just a wonderful atmosphere. And that stadium is incredible at the way it can just pick up energy from the home crowd and just kind of direct it down onto the pitch. The acoustics, whatever they did, the science behind it is quite amazing. That it sounds as loud in there as it does on TV. It's just an incredible stadium and they've done a really good job. But when everybody's together, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And that's why the North London Derby was beautiful. It was just the perfect evening, perfect occasion, perfect result, and just great people in the stadium at that moment.
Best atmosphere you've witnessed?
Yeah, I think so. There was obviously the game against Palace was quite good, and then there was the Man City games, but without doubt, it's one of those moments that we'll look back on it and we'll go, that's when that stadium felt like home. It kind of needed a moment where everyone started forgetting about old White Hart Lane and just started thinking about the new stadium. And I think so. It's the best atmosphere I've seen there.
Nice. I think it was also brilliant because the way the match panned out was fucking hilarious as well. It couldn't have been funnier. And the fact that Arsenal fans think it's so controversial makes it even more hilarious. It wasn't controversial though, Nathan, was it? Your tweet, which I think might be your greatest tweet to date, holding, elbowing, walking, kind of summed it up.
I wasn't expecting that to go off, but yeah, thanks. Yeah, so I did like a tactical video, and I talked about how Arsenal presses in the goal kick in really deep possession, We looked nervous, Sanchez and Royale on the ball, oh God, what's going to happen? It was kind of okay. But then, like, once we'd established position on the midway line, Arsenal dropped into their shape. And, what's his name? Begins with L, forgive me. There's an Arsenal fan. No, sorry. An Arsenal fan on Twitter pointed out something that I didn't quite click when I made my video, which is that, like, because they didn't adapt their pressing shape, because they sat in their normal shape, they were just outnumbered. So every time they pushed up to chase a back pass, there was always just one of our wide centre backs with just acres and acres of space, and we could just continually work that over and over again. So once Arsenal were pinned back, they just had no way out. Which is not the way to play against Conte's Tottenham. Like, you've got, especially if you've got, you know, Davinson and Royale in the back line, you've got to punish that. So they just let us into their game, went away. And to be honest, I think that's kind of where the analysis ends in that game. There wasn't much more detail than that. Mainly what happened is that we dominated on an individual level. We won our duels, and especially Son walked Rob Holding like a dog.
There was a slight moment of concern where Son kind of retaliated a little bit. And to be honest, perhaps he should have had a booking for that. Kind of like threw an arm back towards Holding to say, get off me, because he'd already had two or three goes at him by then. But Holding was like every challenge that Holding made should have been a yellow card, to be honest. He was walking a tightrope from very early on. Son, like you say, had him on strings. He couldn't cope. Carragher did some really good analysis on Monday Night Football, or it might have been Neville. One of them did some analysis about how we played into Son's feet from early on. It was Sessegnon, Davis, I think Kiwi Bear with one of the passes. And on one occasion, Holding hadn't committed to following him, and straight away Son turned and we had possession of their half and like created our first good piece of threatening play from that. And Holding not only felt he had to get tight to Son, which I think is legitimate, I think that's a legitimate tactical strategy, but he felt he had to bully Son, and that is not. That's foolish.
Well, I think there was an attempt to provoke some. We've kind of seen this before with him kicking out Rudiger, with his foul on Andre Gomes. Must be another as well.
Sending off in at Bournemouth.
There you go. Where he's repeatedly being physically bullied, he can lash out in a way that is you know, going to get him sent off. So I suspect there was an intention to try to get at Son that way, but he just did such a poor job. And on the other end, Son did such a good job of riding it. I think Son shouldn't have elbowed him. I think that could have been the moment that they were looking for. But once he didn't get sent off, and he could just draw further fouls out of Holding. Cedric left Holding in a lot of trouble. He kept pushing up onto Sessegnon, who made really good plays to get around him and find Son. Isolated in a lot of space against Holding. And he just isn't going to, you know, just turn and keep up with Son all the way back to goal, is he? So, and Son just made such a good advantage of that situation over and over again.
Absolutely. So the other incident that the Arsenal fans really don't like is the penalty call. I think it's such an obvious penalty. I mean, yes, it's something we see defenders do all the time, but they normally time it better. They normally kind of barge into the back when the ball's about to arrive, not before the player's even got off the ground. And it just looked so clumsy because Son was just starting to jump for the ball as he got a barge in the back. And so obviously he's going to, you know, it's stopping him getting up for the ball. So of course he's going to go down. It was just really foolish.
It was too early. You're right. He just waited a fraction of a second more. The referee wouldn't have taken a look at it, but you can't do that before the ball arrives.
Yeah, yeah. Craziness.
I want to give a little shout. Well, we don't need to give him a shout out, but Kane on penalties once again.
Oh, yeah.
He and Ramsdale, obviously, they know each other. I think maybe they even spent, don't even know if they spent the summer in the same camp for the Euros. But Ramsdale tried to psych him out, and Kane just dealt with him and just cleanly put it the other side of him. He's getting to that point now where you would bet big money on him scoring his penalties.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the statistics came up on the screen and showed which way he goes. And we're all thinking, okay, is he going to change it up and is that going to throw him off? But nope, he just buries them. And
well, the truth
the
is,
same against Burnley.
If he goes left and the goalkeeper goes that same side, it's still unlikely the goalkeeper's going to save him because he's so good at it. But he switched it up nicely. It wasn't the perfect penalty, but it didn't matter because the goalkeeper was just too focused on going one way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. The Burnley pen was so tucked in the side netting that I don't think you can save it, if even if you go the right way. He's ridiculous. He's absolutely ridiculous. So Charlie Coop says, can you dedicate a good amount of time to Davinson, who came in, looked nervy, but put in two solid shifts and had better line-breaking passes than I remember ever seeing him do? I mean, Romero's a tough guy to replace. Romero is one of our best players. And the thing about Romero is he's not just a brilliant defender, he's a brilliant playmaker as well. So you kind of have to lower the bar a little. It's not fair to expect Sanchez to come close to what Romero can do.
Sure.
And I think it's also not fair to expect any centre-back to come close to what Romero can do. So you lower the bar, and Davinson did an adequate job, I thought. You know, it's tough to come in when you've not played for a long time, and he didn't look unfit. He looked like he kind of got the tempo of both games really quickly. His passing was all right. I mean, I'm not sure I agree. And Nathan made the point actually in his video that Sanchez's passing has improved under Conte. I don't think I agree with that. I think his passing is really exposed, to be honest, in Conte's system. I think it looks even worse because of the fact that he's asked to play out so much.
I kind of think both. I kind of think like more is being asked of him. He stepped up a little, but everything that's missing is glaringly obvious.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, I think you're being a bit harsh, Windy. Yeah, he's playing a ball playing defender role, which is going to highlight his weaknesses. But he does okay. He's kind of learnt that pass into Kane, into the forward just inside the box. Is what the third goal came from. And there was a few other occasions where that little pass into Kane worked. And I think if he just keeps focusing on that one pass and then one other, he'll be fine. I'm not going to stand here and say that he's an adequate replacement for Romero, because very few players are. But I thought he gave it a good job in very difficult circumstances. He could have come in and just fallen over his feet and really messed it up. But he was solid. And against Burnley, there was a moment where him and Emerson played the ball out neatly from our corner flag, and we broke, and Son had a good chance to seal the game. So I think we should give a lot of credit to Davinson. He did good.
So let's talk a little bit about the Burnley game, as you've segued nicely there, Bardi.
I would like to say Højbjerg was excellent against Arsenal. He had a fantastic game. There wasn't much pressure on him. He had virtually the whole midfield to himself, but he was good. And I enjoyed his performance, and he was solid. And yeah, it was one of the best I've seen him play. So I just want to say that, because people always go, oh, you always go against, you're just being Arsenal Fan TV by always going after Højbjerg, which I'm trying, I'm not. But he was excellent against Arsenal, so fair play.
I think
he's got anything to prove to me, of course.
I think the second half of the season, Højbjerg has been fantastic. I think he's had a good season on the whole, but the second half, I think he's come on really strong. It's probably partly because he's got an understanding with Bentancur now. Before it was, you know, his partner would change fairly regularly, and it's difficult to create relations. And playing twice a week was difficult as well. Yeah, playing once a week really suits him, and I think he's really, really stepped up. I've been super impressed with Højbjerg. So Burnley, there was another change. We had Lucas in for Kulusevski. Kulusevski had been unwell in the lead-up to the game. Obviously, that was a big blow. We know how important Kulusevski is to our team in all manner of ways. For me, the Burnley game was similar to one of the games where, like, a month ago we'd have won 4-0. I felt like we steadily created chances throughout the game, and Nick Pope was absolutely fantastic. And it was really, really difficult to beat him, you know? Made good saves from Son in particular. And then we got the little bit of luck just before halftime with the penalty call, which for me was, a pretty clear-cut penalty. I think people don't like the kind of the ball to hand thing, but it's not been that way for many years now. And the clear giveaway from Ashley Barnes was where he kind of thrust his chest forward a little bit. And what he's doing there is deliberately trying to make himself big. And in doing so, he's got his arm out. So if the ball hits your arm, it's fair game. It's a penalty. Absolutely no doubt. But again, the Arsenal conspiracy theory types are not happy with this.
Yeah, it's definitely one where you look at the VAR replay or whatever in isolation. It's like, yeah, sure, that makes sense as a penalty. But in the flow of the game, it felt really
It did.
Plucked, because play had gone on some time. I missed that there were shouts for it. Like, it was like, oh, okay, we're going to go into halftime at 0-0 now. And then there was like, nope, we've decided we're going to do a water goal to Tottenham before the end of halftime. I was like, okay, cool, nice. and I knew that that would, like, get the Arsenal fans riled up again. And I tweeted just before the Arsenal-Newcastle game, like, if this conspiracy mindset has got into the squads and they're in big trouble, and I don't know, they were fucking terrible against Newcastle, so yeah.
So the only thing I would say about the Burnley game, and let me reiterate again, I think we played really well. I thought we created good chances. There was definitely a little bit of sluggishness, kind of slight hangover from the Arsenal game, sure, for me. And I thought it was particularly noticeable when we tried to play crossfields and underhit them. It was like there was a kind of heavy-leggedness about some of the passing. I noticed Son, Kane, I want to say Emerson Royale as well, all underhit crossfields in the early part of that game. But on the whole, I thought we came through it really well. Sessegnon had a very strong performance. He was man of the match, voted man of the match by the fans. Thoroughly deserved, has really stepped up these past two games again, and all was well in the world.
I think the Burnley game was just an awkward time. It was we'd played Liverpool, Arsenal. It was a really early kickoff. There was sluggishness there. They looked, even Lucas, who's normally just pure legs, he looked slow. And there was a tension in the crowd as well. And as the game went on and it was just 1-0, you could feel it. And it was an uncomfortable game. Whereas I wasn't too concerned about Arsenal. Burnley was always the game I was the most worried about, because I could just see something happening. And we know sometimes against a low block, we can get nullified and stopping the ball into Kane. So I was really worried about this game. And the longer it stayed 1-0 and the longer Pope kept making incredible saves, the more I started to be concerned that they would get a scrawny goal and then that would be that.
I was definitely, once again, really worried about the late team news of Kulusevski being out with illness and Moura being in his place, because, you know, if there's one thing you need against Burnley, it's sort of creativity and great ball delivery, some guile, and then obviously Kulusevski for Moura is the opposite direction of that. But we've seen something really interesting develop on the right side of the pitch, right? So originally we had, under Conte, we had Moura and Royale, and obviously in the 3-4-3 setup, Moura plays inside the channel and Royale hugs the touchline, and eventually the two of them are traded out for Kulusevski and Doherty. And in that situation, they start to develop a better understanding where Kulusevski moves wide and Doherty moves inside, which is great. And those two are really working well as a partnership. Since then, Doherty's got injured. Royale's come in. Royale has started to pick up the Doherty position with Kulusevski staying wide. And then what we saw finally in the Burnley game is Moura stay wide and Royale tuck in. So we're back to our original pairing on the right side, but they're now adopting around the roles that Kulusevski has influenced. Now, I think that it would have been great for us to arrive at that point without needing sort of a player to point us in that direction. I think that if we'd been using Royale as this sort of inverted wing-back role and Moura as a touchline hunger, which is more of his kind of game anyway, from the off, where he's isolated 1v1 against his man, you know, and he made good use of that against Burnley, then we might have seen better performances out of the two of them back when they were sort of default first choice. But I'm glad we arrived there now. I do think that we're beginning to develop a bit of a thing at right back where we're going to have to pick between Doherty and Royale. You know, we're going to have to decide who we want to plan around, who we're shipping out. And because I still think you want to bring in like a megastar, right? You want to bring in like a brilliant, brilliant right back to be first choice. But at this point, both Doherty and Royale have proven themselves quite worthy of being second choice. So I think that's becoming a slightly tough decision. It doesn't change too much what's on our shopping list, of course.
Do you think this is because Conte's found a workaround? Because neither Doherty or Emerson are natural kind of flying wing, not the same kind of wing backs like Sessegnon or Reguilón are. Do you reckon he's just stumbled upon a workaround? And when it worked with Doherty, he thought, okay, let's do it with Emerson, who's also got limitations in other areas.
Pretty much, I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
It's nice.
I mean, I think it might have been something, I don't know if we actually started this match that way. I think we might have drifted into the match later in that setup. It looked like at first Moura was in narrow and Royale was at wide, and then there was a switch maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes in, or maybe I just didn't catch it for the first 20 minutes, but yeah.
People didn't like my tweets on this, Nathan.
Okay, go
I referred to Emerson Royale playing the Cancelo role rather than the Trent Alexander-Arnold role, and people were like, "You can't compare him to Cancelo," which is yeah, absolutely fair enough. But the point
the Fabian
stands
Delph
that,
role.
Yeah, the Fabian Delph role. I think him stepping inside really suits him because he's not ambitious at taking a man on, and coming inside to take a man on is a lot easier. You're committing less, so it's safer. And he's got a nice level of composure to him when he steps inside, and he's very sensible with his passing. He's very tactically astute.
Finally seeing that sort of upside of his short passing game that I bigged up before he came, and we haven't seen at all till now.
Yeah, I mean, on the sort of point around which should we sell, I think we do still sell Emerson Royale because we'll get a good fee for him.
We should
I think he would be really excellent at a club that plays a style that suits him. And I think he could be pretty good at Spurs as well, but he's not going to excel. I think, you know, we can still add another.
Okay.
You know, the way I saw Sessegnon play against Burnley and to some degree against Arsenal, I was thinking, wow, if we had like a super attacking right wing back and a little bit of the pressure was off Sessegnon and it was coming down both sides.
Then he's the surprise.
Goodness, exactly. He's the one arriving at the back post on the end of a right wing back's crosses. I think that's a really exciting prospect. Mm.
Yeah, I was going to say the wing back that you can compare to Cancelo is Sessegnon, just in terms of numbers and just in terms of how it's playing. I've been a bit concerned about Sessegnon over the last couple of years, but his performances recently and the way he's developing and the way he's understanding, and people get upset with him for not taking on the fullback or just making those runs. But I think it's not a case of that. I think it's him understanding when to go and when not to go, because he does do that run beyond the defensive line and he does take on his man, but he's got that intelligence to know when to do it and not just do it blind like we see with Reggion, who just sometimes just doesn't think about what he should be doing at that moment. I think Sess is a really smart player and I'm really excited by him.
He's kind of like the anti-Reguilon, because Reguilon is so frantic and can't kind of work out what he wants to do, whereas Sessegnon is calm-headed and composed and he knows what he wants to do, but he will wait for the right moment to achieve it. He wants all of the circumstances to be right for him to make that darting run. And so sometimes he'll play safe. And I think it's completely fine for him to play safe, especially when he can then pull out assists like he did for Son's goal against Liverpool and like some of the fantastic expected assists that he racked up in the next two games. Really, really impressive from Sessegnon, creating at a very high rate at the moment.
There was a question on Twitter. We had a lot of responses to the tweet, ask us a question. And it was a photo of Reguilon in the kind of lap of honour at the end of the season.
Mm.
And I think when you take one of these photos out of context, anybody could look miserable. You could have taken a photo of Kane and gone, oh, that face means he wants to leave. But I do think now if an offer comes in for him, we will sell him and just focus on Sessegnon instead. It just makes sense in terms of homegrown and everything else for Europe. Yeah. So I can't believe that this is the way it is now.
I can believe it, and I'm not sorry in a way. I think Reguilon's fine, and
I'd like to keep him. I'd be all right with keeping him another season.
I don't think we're going to get the 40 million in his buyback. I'd be surprised if we got that, but I think we can still get a good fee for him. We at least get our money back, which a couple of years on is fine, right?
Yeah, but I could do. I'm happy to see another season with him.
So Russ says, "Was the nature of the Burnley win the straw that broke Arsenal's back?" What do we think to that one?
I mean, I think if you're going to think about Spursiness, losing to Burnley would have been proper Spursiness. And the fact that we didn't, and we ground out a result and it was 1-0 and the rest of it, I think that probably did have an impact on Arsenal. For the first time, it really put the pressure on them. So I think that had a huge impact on them.
For sure. I mean, I think the combination of the two is what did for Arsenal, you know, absolutely destroyed by their local rivals. You know, we played in second gear in the second half. That's how comfortable we were. We barely had to try. And then a man sent off, obviously. So they're slightly more tired than you'd be if you had 11 players. And then seeing us ahead of their game, a day ahead, do what we needed to do, essentially. Put the pressure on, exactly. So they go into their game against a resurgent Newcastle team, feeling sorry for themselves, just been really beaten heavily in the match that really matters against a team that's competing with them. Young team. And, you know, Arteta, I think, was the most rattled of anyone. his post-Spurs interview showed him just absolutely losing it. And that filters through to the players. I mean, I'm sure we'll see this in All or Nothing, which, my God, I cannot wait to watch. It's not going to look great for Arteta. I think, you know, he's an inexperienced young manager, and I'm sure he'll learn from this, but he absolutely fucked it. He really fucked it on this occasion. And it wasn't a surprise to me that Newcastle beat Arsenal. I thought they'd beat them, but the sheer dominance that Newcastle showed in that game, that was a surprise. I was not expecting Newcastle to have like 65-70% possession in the first half.
Some of the commentary that's been coming out around Arsenal and about their thin squad and about their young squad has been annoying me. I mean, they played 44 games this season, which is nothing. They've spent a fortune. The reason why the squad is so thin is because he's booted players out. I don't think he was forced to sell Aubameyang. He could have gone into the end of the season without relying on Nketiah and Lacazette, who's leaving as well at the end of the season. He's alienated large sections of his squad. He's promoted players who really aren't that good. They've bought players who aren't that good. They signed Ramsdale, who had a really incredible start to the season, but that was an outlier according to like what he normally is. He's not a good goalkeeper who happened to have a good run of form, and now we're seeing his performance drop, and he's now playing like a goalkeeper that's been relegated a couple of times. So I think Arteta, I don't give him any credit for being a good manager. He's not. I don't give him a good credit for building a team or weaseling out the bad players. He's a bad manager who didn't need to win the North London Derby. He could have gone there, parked the bus, shithoused the place, got a 0-0, and then gone back and been all right. Instead, they arrived there and they just showed the rest of the world how to beat them. And you just pressed them. And they fell apart.
Do you know what it reminded me of a little bit? It reminded me of when we used to play Liverpool under Pochettino.
Mm. Well, I mean, Arsenal remind me a lot of Spurs in the early 2000s, where just because the team is young and they've got some interesting young English players, everyone's like, oh, maybe we can be good. But they're so brittle and so fragile.
Not going anywhere, are they? It sounds like there should be some promise, but they're just, it's not there.
Yeah. Ben White, he just spends all his time on a tanning bed. He's not a good footballer. Elneny is a guy that 3 years ago Unai Emery was trying to get rid of, and now he's getting new contracts. He's just managed this team so badly. And you're right, I'm looking forward. Let's do an episode by episode commentary on All or Nothing. they're terrible. And watching his face as they got spanked brought me great, great joy.
Have any of the teams with an All or Nothing recording won anything yet? Are we going to start referring to the All or Nothing curse?
I think Juventus maybe won something. And Man City won the league with 100 points, didn't they? Yeah.
It's just us.
Right, and Arsenal.
Yeah. I think this is huge for Arsenal, not qualifying for the Champions League this year. And I know they weren't expected to, but it's... when your expectations get raised partway through the season and then crushed again at the end, touch wood, hopefully, it's pretty brutal. It's pretty brutal. And the fact that on their way up, Arteta signed a new 5-year contract is absolutely hilarious. I think they've really overdone that. I think 5 years is a crazy contract to give him at this stage in his career. I mean, I think Arteta's a good coach, right? I think he's an Eddie Howe level coach.
Sure.
To give him a 5-year contract is... I don't know. I think that is really foolish. And the thing is, I can't see them getting Champions League next year either, unless they sign incredibly well. So Saka's not going to hang around forever. I could see Saka ending up at a club like Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. He'd be so good for Liverpool as well.
Yeah, you know, like long-term replacement for Salah. It would work really nicely. And you look at the rest of the squad, and like, but I mean, I think there's some quality in the Arsenal squad. To be honest, I think there's some good players. Unlike Bardi, I think Ben White's. I think Ben White's a quality player. I think Ben White would be unbelievable in Spurs' system.
He's not getting in our back three. He doesn't replace anybody in our back three.
Oh, he would
replace Davinson on the bench.
Yeah, he would replace Davinson on the bench.
He doesn't get in front of Ben.
I think he'd be our second best after Romero. But let's not talk about Ben White. I mean, I think like the whole...
Wait. Who are you dropping for Ben White?
Dyer or Davis?
I'm very, very critical of Dyer, but I wouldn't drop him. And Ben White's not playing on the left of that back three with the same elegance, composure and measure as Ben. Ben Davies got booked early in that first half against Arsenal, and that easily could have the game could have swept him by. He could have been pressed, everything else. But he's just so calm and so good that it just didn't matter. And his relationship with Sessegnon looked really good against Burnley. Ben Davies, for me, player of the year. He's unbelievable how he's transformed. Drop it, Ben Davies for Ben White. I'm worried about you, Windy.
I think he's good. I think he's really good. I think he'll be England's first choice centre-back and Dyer won't make the squad. So, you know, I really like Eric Dyer. I think Eric Dyer's had a brilliant season, but I'm just saying, I think Ben White's a good player. But I think the rest of their squad is so patchy. They've got quality scattered within it, but they're going to... Partey has had half a good season. Xhaka is... You know, the most basic of players. He's all right. He's not great when times get tough. Elneny's their third choice central midfielder. He's nothing to write home about. They need to completely revamp their central midfield again. They need to completely revamp their front line again. This is a team that is miles off what they want, what they think they're going to achieve.
Well, they keep selling decent players. Torreira has had a pretty strong season in Italy. What's his face? Guendouzi, I think he's done all right.
Yeah, he's good.
In Marseille. You know, there's two midfielders that are immediately better than the midfield that they played against us.
I think so.
And that's on Arteta, his inability to manage squads.
And if they had Bellerin instead of Cedric Suarez, they might not have completely left holding exposed again.
Yeah. Exactly. And this is on Arteta. He's walking around like he's Conte, but he's not. Not even close to being Conte. And yeah. I've got to say, the way Conte schooled him in the post-match comments about... I think it was maybe Jack Pitbrook that said it, that Conte didn't complain, but by complaining about Arteta, he managed to air all his complaints and take a dig at Arteta. It was an amazing bit of media, and he's a fantastic manager. I think I'm in love with Antonio Conte. I liked him a lot before he came, but he's something else, and he's a wonderful, wonderful manager. And if we only have him for two more years, then it doesn't matter. I'm not one of these people that are going to start complaining he needs to sign a five-year deal. He doesn't need to. Have two more years of Antonio Conte doing incredible things with this team, and we'll win something. I have full faith in that.
I wanted to talk a bit about that because unlike a lot of Spurs fans, Nathan and I have insisted that Spurs have had good players all along and that he just needed a good coach to put it together. But what I'll say on that is it's not the good players that we expected, you know?
Sure.
It's Ndombele, Lo Celso, Dele, players that, you know, Hill, I think Bergvine. Are really talented. Exactly. Players that I think are really talented and I was hoping and expecting Conte to get something out of. He didn't use those, but he used other players that
Jobbers.
We were saying... Yeah, we like Dyer, Davis, players that we thought might leave in the summer. Buddy, you just said the same about Højbjerg. You weren't sold on him, yep. Particularly at the start of the year. So, but I think the point stands that you get a good coach who has a system that works and who can improve players, and you watch players who have previously been written off improve, and we see it time and time and time and time again. I think people just need to take a bit more of a long-term approach with their judgment of players and accept that they go through fluctuations. Same with Emerson Royale this season, same with Matt Doherty. And I'm guilty of it. We're all guilty of it, but some more than most. You just have to accept that not every player works for every coach, but give them a chance and allow, you know, they're Premier League players for a reason. Spurs signed them for a reason. They're not just trash because they're not winning in that moment. And it's been lovely to see the resurgence of some of our players. And Bardi's mentioned Davis there. He's a great example of it. But find him a position that works for his current skill set and watch him excel. You know, he's had a fantastic attitude and temperament for many years. And now he's found the position that works for him. And it's a joy to behold. We're seeing the resurgence of Sessegnon now, who I think is such a talented player. And I'm sure there'll be someone else next year who will surprise us again.
Harry Kane. Harry Kane was on his... He was out. He wanted to be... He wanted gone. And even though he started playing again under Nuno, he was just playing because he realised he needed to score goals if he had any hope of breaking any records. But under Conte, he's a new person again. And he looks completely invested into this project. Yeah. And I have no fear in Kane leaving now, especially with Haaland going to City. Yeah. I don't see Kane going anywhere else. I think he's going to buy into this. He'll get himself a nice new contract. Maybe there'll be a release clause, but I think Kane stays as long as Conte stays.
Yeah, so this is something we spoke about a while back. It's like I was saying, I'm sort of not that worried about top four this year. And you pointed out that, that Conte and Kane staying might be dependent on that. And that very much seemed the case for quite a while. But then the message coming from the club, from Conte himself, from the journalists connected to Spurs, is that it's not dependent on top four anymore. Now, I still think we're going to take fourth because Arsenal get bad air every go. But I think that like that's safe and that's secure regardless, and that feels really good. But like, just from my personal perspective, I'm enjoying the team in this push for top four since, I guess, Liverpool. I'm enjoying Spurs in the way that I haven't for quite a while. You know, I'm really, since the Champions League final, really, I'm really loving being a Spurs fan, and I'm jumping out of my seat and shouting and waking up the neighbours' children because Newcastle have scored against Arsenal on a Monday night. I'm really loving being a Spurs fan again, and that means so much. And yeah, of course, all of that just comes back from a team is winning games and Conte's ability to get the most out of the players at the club. But it's what it comes down to, what it means to a fan, you know?
I don't think it is just about winning, though, because Mourinho had spells of winning and it didn't feel the same.
Okay.
It's the winning, but it's also you can see what's being implemented and you can even see room for further growth.
Where it's
and
going. That
is
yeah.
really exciting. Like the system is really, he honed it so nicely in these last few games, and the way we soaked up pressure against Liverpool and then used that as a blueprint to play Arsenal. Yeah, it's nice.
I do think a lot of it does come down to when you start winning your games as well. Like Mourinho had his period at Christmas where he won a lot of games and people were talking about a title. But I think crowds back in the stadium has been a huge impact on this, and just the fact that Kane is back playing, and Conte is a mesmeric figure, and Conte Cam, the rest of it, he's a brilliant manager, and he's really good at getting the fans on side. Even those that are very Conte sceptical, I'm sure this week are back on board with Conte. And if you're seriously thinking that Conte is not the right fit for Tottenham and someone like Potter would be, then I think you need to, like what I'm kind of trying to do with your Hjulberg is try and look at things a little bit differently. Yeah. Try and admit that I was maybe wrong about Hjulberg. Can you believe it? 10 years of podcasting, I've never admitted I was wrong, but I may be getting that way. Maybe arriving at that point.
I mean, I do think both Conte and Potter can be good fits for Spurs, but let's just enjoy Conte while we've got, like you said, he might only be here for 2-3 years. Let's just enjoy him while we've got him, because he is truly elite. And he's the only manager we could have who could put us in a position, I think, where we could really challenge for things next year. He's the only one. I find that very exciting. I really think if we get Champions League, and I truly believe we will, I think we'll beat Norwich, I think Arsenal will lose. I think the money will really help, obviously. The extra money that you get from being in the Champions League means we can be a little bit more ambitious with our transfer business. But I think the prestige and the good feeling that it creates within the club, I think that elevates Spurs as an option for a lot of players. And I really feel like, you know, we sign an elite right wing back, left centre back, perhaps left wing back, backup striker. Oh my goodness, we're going to be such a good team. You know, I think we're good now. I think we're good with the first choice 11 now. I think we're good even with the first 11 to 15 now. You bring in players at kind of Kulusevski, Bentancur level to fill those roles, and we're going to be really something to watch next year. It is very, very exciting to be a Spurs fan right now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is an interesting tactical question from Ted Stewart. He says, do you think the last two results indicate that we can now cope playing against a high-press Arsenal and a low-block Burnley, or are they outliers? What do you think, Nathan? Have we seen sort of two sides to Conte's system?
Sure, yes, I guess so. I still think we did struggle when Arsenal pressed us. Obviously, again, there's a Davinson-Romero situation there. And I still think, so I did a video like almost straight after Conte signed, and I looked at his performance, well, especially Inter, but also a bit of Chelsea, about how they played with really good high-pressing sides. Not high-pressing generally, because a lot of what Conte does is to draw a team out to press you high by passing backwards to the keeper a lot and stuff like that. But against really competent high-pressing sides, Conte does struggle from time to time. Still got decent results at Inter against those sides, but the performances were kind of worrying. And a low block from time to time. Like, again, Conte's method of dealing with a parked bus for most of his career has been to just go at them with the wing backs, cross, 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 dribble, dribble, cross, until they give in. And then it's a different game plan from 1-0, because you can open up the game more. And he's good at doing that too. But yeah, I mean, a Conte team could still lose games, right? Obviously. Mm. But we are definitely seeing the progress in both of those areas for sure.
Matt D says, has a Spurs manager ever owned someone like Conte owned Arteta this past week and throw the reaction he got out of Klopp as the cherry on top?
No, I mean, we've touched on this. I don't think so. I don't think an Arsenal manager's ever been owned quite like this. And he did rattle Klopp as well. And that's a testament to how he set us up and the player, how the players played. I thought we were great against Liverpool. And if we'd got, imagine if we'd got those 3 points, we'd already be qualified.
Alex C says, are any of you guys concerned about Conte's track record in European competitions, as well as his struggles to manage multiple games a week? And how do you feel we'll go next season in both the Champions League and Premier League because of it?
Yes, I am. Quite frankly, I am. I am worried about that. I'm worried about how that will... I'm more worried about how being in European, like important European competition will affect our Premier League performance than I am about how, like, if we just have a bad Champions League run and we crash out, whatever, you know, we'll be back. Yeah. But the important thing is being back. Yeah. Buddy was just talking about, you know, Conte is the right man for the job. You don't need to worry about Potter. But I'm also thinking about, like, long term. Yeah. After Conte goes, maybe Potter's the man then, or someone else is, or whatever. Someone else comes along. But yeah, my concern is I'm definitely worried about, two games a week, two important games a week for a lot of next season. And I think that I've been thinking about this a lot recently, why that is. There's definitely, and I've been learning as the season has gone along, there's definitely a lot more individual match-to-match preparation that Conte provides than I previously thought. We've seen those tweaks week on week in much more detail, and that's been quite eye-opening. But also, I suspect that his team's periodization is leaning quite heavily towards one game a week. I think that he has some not necessarily like outdated, but kind of old school experts in that area that make up part of his team, and that things are just geared that way. Yeah, I think that it's not just missed tactical preparation. I think you can see legginess when you play a second game in a week a lot of the time.
I agree, and I did have some concerns about his rotation also. But he'll know this. He'll be very aware of his record in Europe over the years, and I'm sure he'll want to do something about that. I do think we're at an advantage next year compared to this year in that we already know the system now. So the core group of players know the system. They know what's expected of them. We'll have a pre-season for those that don't know the system, and that will help. And hopefully that will help to kind of just keep grinding out the Premier League results whilst the Champions League stuff's ongoing. My view is more that the Champions League might not go so well, but the Premier League will continue to go well. But I think if he rotates heavily in the Champions League, especially in the early rounds, that's the way to do it.
Do we have the squad for that? Or do you think we will have the squad for that?
I think we'll need to buy quite a bit. And I think, you know, I also think we've got some young players, depending on, you know, the group stages. And we're getting so far ahead of ourselves talking Champions League if we haven't qualified yet, but what the hell. If we get a good draw in the group stages, in the early stages, where we can play players like, I don't go crazy, Troy Parrott, you know? That would be really helpful, because we've got a wider squad that we can use, who can just do enough to kind of keep you in it, get you through it, and give players like Harry Kane a rest.
I mean, I'm not too bothered about his Champions League record. If his Champions League record the last two seasons, his two seasons at Inter, were kind of standard for Italian teams anyway. They don't progress very far in the Champions League. And even his final one at Inter, Martinez missed like 8 open goals. And Vidal got sent off really early against Real Madrid. So he was up against it and he nearly got out of the group. But it was a tough group. But listen, I'm not worried about it now. I'll worry about it when it happens. For now, I'm just looking forward to hopefully qualifying for the Champions League and being back in it. It doesn't concern me what we're going to do, what we're not going to do. I just want to get there and then enjoy the summer thinking about it. It's a wonderful problem to have, qualifying for the Champions League, and then us having to think about what we're going to do there. It's a position of privilege, so I'm not worried about it now. I'll be concerned about it if we lose our first two games, if we're back in.
Okay, so we had an email from someone who wishes to remain anonymous about hair loss. Let me read you half of this, and then we'll have a chat about it. Then I'll read you the next bit, because I think it's interesting. I think I feel like we can handle this sensitively. So this anonymous correspondent said that they started noticing that they were losing their hair when they were 19. He says, as someone who was particularly self-conscious, this really affected me. Initially, I paid for treatment from a seemingly reputable trichologist in London. This was pre-internet, so harder to do research. It was incredibly expensive and produced very little results. Having forked out over £4,000 in just over a year, I started to use Regain, which was available over the counter from Boots. It was far more affordable, £60 for about 2 months of treatment, but didn't appear to achieve much other than to possibly slow down the recession in the front corners of my hairline. The biggest issue, though, was trying to hide the fact that I was using Regain, so if I was ever going on holiday with friends or staying away, I'd always have to hide the bottle. Fast forward a few years and I was still losing more hair, including on the crown. People would always assume that I was a lot older than I was, and at the time was still perennially single, which I put down to my appearance. I was lured by an advert by a well-known non-clinical hair treatment studio in London, so went to see what they could offer. I was given a pretty good sales pitch and walked out having committed to just under £3,000 for a new head of hair, despite not really understanding the mechanics of what I'd signed up for. I came back to them 4 weeks later for a fitting, which I then discovered was essentially a wig. Although no one in the industry ever calls it that, it is a hair system or unit as the preferred terminology. I've never been so anxious in my life as the next day going into work, which was a very lads banter sort of workplace. Needless to say, it convinced no one and I had to live in ridicule for a while. However, after a while, the comments stopped, and as people left and new colleagues started, it was never mentioned, at least not to my knowledge. I started to experiment with different styles and I knew how to look more authentic. I have since found more affordable ways of purchasing and maintaining these hair systems. I now pay about £300 per unit, which usually lasts 4 to 5 months with maintenance. I very rarely receive any comments, though sometimes when a new unit is fitted, it doesn't instantly blend well with my natural hair colour around the side, and the colour can sometimes fade over time, which can be a bit of a giveaway. I rarely talk to anyone about it. It was a very awkward subject to raise when dating, though I did tell my now wife on our first date, and I've lived to tell the tale. My children, aged 7 and 6, do not know that I have a hair system, and I'm always particularly nervous when they climb on me or want piggybacks. I don't play football through fear of what might happen if I had the ball, and swimming is not recommended as the chlorine can do bad things to the hair colour. So, okay, that's the first chunk of the email. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, guys. What did you take from that so far?
I mean, it's committed a lot of money to it. I can't comment, but I can see, just from talking to people who have lost their hair, it's something that really affects them, and I can understand why they're willing to do that and commit £7,000 plus to it.
It's a lot of money. That's a life-changing amount of money to spend on what is essentially cosmetics. And this is the thing, hair loss is so damaging. I found it really, really, really damaging for my ego, my self. Like I didn't want to look at myself in the mirror when I saw gaps in my hair. And I've mentioned this in the previous pod, I've found shaving my head really liberating. I've gotten even shorter now, so it's like literally like pretty much skin. And the reaction I've had has been good. It's, people have said, yeah, it looks fine, you know, it looks all right. Don't worry about it. And getting to that place where you don't worry about it is the important thing. It's really tough to get there though. And I really felt, when I read this email, I really felt it. I really felt like so bad for this guy. And you know, the bit that I struggle with is not wanting your children to climb on you and play with you. You know, that's such a big thing to have to deal with all the time. It must be constantly there as a reminder. And I just wish I could kind of give you a hug, mate, and say, you're going to be fine without your hair system. You're going to be absolutely fine. And people won't worry about it within weeks. And your children are still going to love you. And they'll probably rub your head. They'll probably love rubbing your head. it's a tough one to read.
Yeah, there's definitely very clearly a lot of anxiety coming through in this email. About like trying to hide the fact that you were using Regain, about not telling anyone apart from your wife, about the fear of your you know, your children not knowing, all those kinds of things. And I'm not saying like, because I'm now using Regain myself. And yeah, I'm not blown over by the results so far myself either. I think that you know, definitely, sure, use a hair system, whatever you call it. Use Regain, etc. If that's what you want to do, but the first thing to do is you've got to make more peace with your situation. I think there's clearly some processing you need to go through there, because at the moment you're in a situation where you're like terrified of anyone knowing, and like there doesn't need to be that fear at all. And obviously, like you're in a work situation where it's a laddie banter kind of thing, and you know that they're going to take the piss out of you, and then that materialize, and that's going to compound those fears and really fix that on you. But basically, as Windy and I have been discovering, no one cares. No one cares if you're bald. You know, have a system you take on and off. I want to have hair, but it's okay when I don't. You know. You've got to fight that face on. You've got to be seen in public in a way that you think is unacceptable, because it's completely acceptable, and you've got to explore making peace with that. And then everything from there is downhill and will be much easier for you.
If what Nathan said, it makes a lot of sense there. If nobody cares, people on the street don't know that you're bald. And if you do go bald and you see how your friends react, and 100% sure your friends would be super positive and support you. And if they don't, then maybe consider the fact that they shouldn't be your friends.
Talk to your wife about it, man. get her to open up about how she feels, right? Because that's surely going to guide your decision more than what anyone else thinks.
Definitely. So let me read the end of this email, and I just want to say again, I really appreciate this listener opening up to us. It's quite touching, actually, that you felt able to. So he says, I'm in a position now where I'm seriously considering no longer wearing them, as it will save a lot of money, potentially £1,000 per year, and it will also be incredibly liberating in many ways. However, I know that I look a lot better with hair than without it, and I'm worried that my self-confidence would be severely impacted should I go back to how I should look naturally. The reason for the lengthy life story is partly for therapeutic purposes, but also because I wanted to raise and ask you to share the sentiment on the pod about the stigma of hair loss for many men. Naturally, you guys on The Extra Inch discuss such matters very sensitively, but I feel it uncomfortable listening to most other people taking the piss out of wigs and hair replacements. This seems to have amplified on Spurs podcasts due to Conte's far more expensive hair treatment. Anyone who goes to the effort and expense of any sort of hair treatment is by nature going to be very image conscious, and it's really unhelpful and sometimes upsetting to indirectly be the source of ridicule. Yeah, I mean, this is the first point you make. Think of the money you're going to save. Think of that £1,000. You can spend it on nice holidays with your family, and you'll have a lovely time, and you'll be
a big hat collection.
Yeah, you'll be bald, so you can go in the sea and swim. Go on a holiday to the coast and swim, and not worry about your hair system being lost, and just enjoy the freedom and the liberation. And you say that you're worried your self-confidence would be severely impacted. I think your self-confidence has already been severely impacted, yeah. And it's not going to get much worse from here. You've done what you've been going through has been really difficult, and I honestly don't believe it's going to be any worse. I think it will remove a barrier for you for enjoying your life. You won't have to worry about your hair system getting knocked off, or, you know, when you have to replace it and what your colleagues might think if they notice. All of that is gone instantly, and you'll feel better for it.
I think so. Taking sort of strays in terms of the way people talk about other bald men, but it's like
Pep.
Yeah, Pep and everyone, but like, people mock Pep because of his character, and they use baldness as a way to sort of weaponize that, right? He emits a bald energy, right? That's the thing.
Yeah? He's so self-confident, isn't he?
Yeah. I think, and Conte as well, like, the thing with Conte, like, have you seen the pictures of him when he was shaven? He looks so good, and it's so fitting for his character because he's such like an authoritarian, hyper-masculine figure. That looks so much better on him than his current hair get up, you know? I don't know. People are gonna mock each other for reasons that they don't necessarily actually fully believe in. You know, it's just a means because Pep's character and his success like attracts ridicule, and the absurd things that he says. Baldness is a way of getting at him, but I don't think most people really own that kind of anti-bald prejudice. I think what gets more mockery is like weak attempts, right, to cover it up, like comb overs and leaving the sides long when you're completely bald on top and all that kind of stuff. And those are all men who, again, are probably in a similar situation to you and need to work through it and make peace with it. So whether that comes in the form of sticking with your current system or looking at other ones or whatever, the most important thing is to address. I think, I don't know how easy it is to go bald for a time being and then maybe return. I don't know if it's such a thing you can take off and put back on, or whether it's a bit more complicated than that, but I would highly recommend, if possible, if feasible, spend some time without any hair, shave it all the way down on the sides, be seen by people old and new, and find it very liberating, because I think you will. And grow
bald
a beard.
Bald Conte looks quite menacing.
He really does.
I totally forgot about that period of his life. He looks really menacing.
Seriously, he does. He does. It's like a different person. I'm just going to say that if I don't have any success when I eventually start dating as a bald man, I'm going to spend the £1,800 and go to Turkey and get my hair done. I'm not against that. But I'm also... I'm enjoying the eggness at the moment. And this is the thing, like, I've preempted the jibes in Discord. I've put the egg in my username. And I'll probably, if ever my picture gets posted on a Twitter account that masses might see, I will probably do the same. Like, you've got to get there first, haven't you? You've got to be the one to be self-deprecating first, I think.
I think you're all dramatically overestimating how strongly women feel about baldness. Especially
possibly.
Like shaven, nice, smooth, even baldness, you know?
It does feel really nice. It's lovely to run your hand over.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, D. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.